For those of you who were here last week, we explained that even though the events of that are recorded in the Sedra of Bamidbar came after the events that are in the end of this week's Sedra Naso, which is the consecration of the Mishkan and God's presence coming into the Mishkan. That's what the end of this week's Sedra speaks about, and the sacrifices that the heads of the tribes brought in consecration of the Mizbeach and the functioning of the Mishkan. The events in Bamidbar, where they made the census and they divided the Jewish people into four camps that dwelt around the Mishkan, each one with its own banner, that came later. That came a month later after the consecration of the Mishkan. Yet it's mentioned first, and we explained last week, because the goal is not to have God's presence amongst us. The goal is that once God's presence is there, for us to dwell around that presence and to function as a cohesive nation, each one bringing out their individual unique mission. That's what we spoke about last week. I want to continue the idea this week, because the beginning of this week's Sedra also are events that happened after the end of what's in the end of the Sedra. So this is a continuation of that idea. What we said last week is that the main goal of having God's presence in Klal Yisrael, and also that applies also the main goal of having the Torah, and the continuation of the giving of the Torah was in the Mishkan. That was the means. That wasn't the goal. The goal was to have the Jewish people dwell around that and focus on it and conduct their lives around the Mishkan, around God's presence. Therefore, in this week's Sedra, as a continuation of that, is the first thing that the Sedra speaks about after it finishes speaking about the various tafkidim, the various roles. Thank you. The various roles of the Leviim finishes off that. Then it speaks about the fact that different kinds of tmeim, people who are spiritually impure, have to be sent out of the camp. Some of them have to be sent out of all three camps, which we'll see in one second what that means. Some only two and some one. What are the camps? So their camp of Shechina is the Mishkan itself. Okay? And that corresponds to the Azora of the Beis HaMikdash. When there was a Beis HaMikdash, the Azora of the Beis HaMikdash, right, the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, was similar to Machane Shechina, the courtyard of the Mishkan. Then there is Machane Leviyah. Machane Leviyah was around the Mishkan, the area where the Leviim, dwelt, immediately around the Mishkan. In the Beis HaMikdash, that was the Har HaBayis, the whole Temple Mount. That was the second Machane. And the third Machane was Machane Yisrael, where all of the regular Jews dwelt, the four Degolim, the four banners around the Leviim who were around the Mishkan. In the Beis HaMikdash, Machane Yisrael was basically the city of Yerushalayim, but it also extended to any walled city. But for practical purposes, up until the walls of Yerushalayim, right, that was called Machane Yisrael. Now, there were three different gradations of Tumah. Somebody who was Tamei Mace, he came in contact with the dead. He was allowed to be in Yerushalayim, in Machne Yisrael. He was allowed to be up on Har HaBayis. Okay? As long as he didn't go into the Azora, into the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash. So he only had to be sent out of the Machne Shechina, out of the Mikdash itself, out of the Mishkan itself. So a Tamei Mace could not be in the place where the Mishkan was or the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, inside the Beis HaMikdash. But he could be up on the Harabayas, he could be on the Temple Mount, or he could be in the place where the Levium, in the Midbar, the Levium dwelt. Then there is a Zov, a Zova. They are people who have tumah come out of their body. A Nida, right? Where the tumah is because of an emission from the body, man or woman. They had to be sent out of two camps. They couldn't be in the Mishkan or in the Beis HaMikdash itself. They couldn't even be in Machne Levia. They couldn't be in the camp of the Leviim or in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. They couldn't be up on the Temple Mount. But they could be in Yerushalayim. And then the third gradation is a Metzora. A Metzora had to be sent out of all three camps. He couldn't be in Yerushalayim, he couldn't be in Machne Yisrael, where the regular Jews were. He had to be out of the camp completely. So he had to be out of the walls of Yerushalayim, and he couldn't even be there. Now, based on the Kli Yakar, but not exactly like the Kli Yakar, but using the Kli Yakar as a basis, I want to explain a little bit this idea. First of all, the Ramban says that once we have a camp, where they're regular Jews, all the tribes, and we have the Levium, we have the Mishkan, right? We have to make sure we maintain it pure so God's presence remains there. If the goal is to have these camps that can identify and attach themselves to God, you want to make sure that you don't do something within those camps that would make God's presence leave. So therefore you have to be careful not to have people that are tamei who would push away God's presence. Now these, and therefore the Lekach Tov, the Medrash says, that once they established the Degolim, the banners, the various camps, now they had to send out the people who were Tomei from those camps, because the camp necessitated purity, that they remain pure so they could have that connection to God. Now, a Metzora, I was thinking like this. There are three major sources of sin: Kina, Taiva, Kovet, right? And there are three major sins: Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, and Avodah Zarah. Okay? Metzora, a leper, usually comes because of Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara comes because usually of jealousy. People are jealous of other people, and therefore Kina leads to Lashon Hara, right? And Lashon Hara and Kina are similar to Avodah Zarah. Why? Because if I'm jealous of somebody else, that means I don't believe that God apportions out the missions, the roles of each person, but I think that people grab whatever they can, and I want what he has, so I want to grab it for him. So the whole concept of losach mode, of not coveting and not being jealous, is where I deny the fact that God is the one who apportions out roles, and I think that I can grab it for myself, and if somebody else has it, I can get what he has, because, you know, it's dog eat dog. Get what you can. So therefore, Lashon Hara is associated with Kina, and Kina is associated with idolatry and Kfira. Right, and that's why it says that there are three Averas: Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, and Avodah Zarah, and Lashon Hara keneged Kulam. Because just like Talmud Torah keneged Kulam, on the good side, Lashon Hara is the antithesis of Torah. Torah is that everything is God's will. And Lashon Hara is that nothing's God's will, and therefore, if this guy, I can speak bad about him because it's his fault, or the fact that he's not smart is his fault, and God doesn't run the world, but the world's just a haphazard thing of accidents or whatever. So therefore, a Metzora can't be in any camp. He is the antithesis of Torah and attachment to God. It's like the denial of God. So that Metzora got to get out of all the camps. Then there's tumah that comes out of the body that is a result, usually, of taiva, of desire. And that desire is connected to Gilui Arayos, to the sin of immorality. And that, a person like that can, what's it called, not be in the place of the Shechinah, nor in the place where the Leviim are, but in the regular Machne Yisrael, he can be. Right? That Tumah doesn't affect the regular camp. He can be in the regular camp. Because it's not very spiritual, but he can still exist amongst people. And then there's Tumas Meis. Tumas Meis, no, he can be in Machne Yisrael, right, not in Machne Levia and not in Machne Shechina. Tumas Meis, a person comes in contact with the dead is connected with Kavod. That a person who mourns too much for the dead sees the Kavod of the person in his physical aspect, not his spiritual aspect. Because if you see that the major thing of a person is neshama, then it's not that much to mourn when somebody dies, because the neshama is still around, just not in the body. But if you consider the body the main thing, then it's devastating when a person dies because his body is incapacitated and dead. But he's not dead, his neshama is still alive. That's why the Torah says, lo siskodidu, don't mourn excessively. Yes, something to mourn, a person dies, no longer here in this physical world. But he's not gone, right? Like I saw some funeral notices in Tel Aviv by secular people. They say, so-and-so einenu, is gone, finished, that's it. You know, what's it called? They disappeared from existence, which is not true. Somebody died, they were nifter, they became exempt from this world, and their neshama went on. So somebody who mourns excessively gives too much credence to the body and not to the soul. And therefore, it says that lo siskodidu also comes to tell me, don't make separate groups of yidden in the same place, people doing different minhagim, different halachas, because it looks like more than one Torah. Because unity comes from the soul. If you emphasize the soul, there's possible unity. If you emphasize the body, we're all separate. So, disunity is a function of emphasizing Gashmias too much. And a person who mourns excessively emphasizes Gashmias more than Ruchnias, because there's nothing to mourn excessively if you believe that the Neshama continues to live. And therefore, Tumas Meis, right, the fact you come in contact with the dead and it makes such an impression on you that it makes you Tamei, so that is related to Shvichas Dami, murder, which has to do also with killing people, what's it called, in this world, and basically not seeing the eternal value of life. And also Kavod, because you really misplace the Kavod of a person if you mourn too excessively. You think that the Kavod of a person is his physical being, and therefore you mourn his not being around physically, whereas if you would really see the real covet of a person as a spiritual side, then you would mourn that excessively. So it's all connected. That is only sent out of Machane Shechinah. There, a person who's involved with covet and death and whatever can't be in the Mikdash, but he could be in the other camps. So therefore, the first topic in this week's Sedra is a continuation of what we had before. The main goal is that the Jewish people should dwell and make a camp around God's presence and create individual and collective roles in being attached to God. In order to do that, you have to make sure that the tumas that could affect the camp being attached to God aren't there. So send the people who are Tomei outside of the camps to maintain the integrity and the purity of the camps. Secondly, there are not only spiritual things that affect the attachment to God, there's also things between man and man. The next topic is Gezel Hagir. You stole something from a convert and you denied stealing it and swore falsely. So you're mixing now sins between man and God, swearing falsely, and man stealing. And not only that, the stealing is to a convert who dies and leaves no heirs. Because every other Jew has an heir, because if he doesn't have children, he has brothers, if he doesn't have brothers, if he has uncles, and Everybody has relatives all the way back to Yaakov Avinu. But a convert has no relatives except his progeny. And if he has no children, he has no relatives. He dies, there's nobody to give the stolen article back to. So I would think, what's the big deal? Right? The guy's dead. Nobody is harmed by this, so keep the stolen thing. No. Stolen things separate between you and God. It says God hates stealing. Hates means he distances himself from it. You can't have stolen property even if nobody's affected. There's nobody who owns it anymore. So what do you do with it? You have to return it to the Kohen. You have to give it to a Kohen. What does it show me? That aside from different kinds of tumah, spiritual impurity, there's things you can do that cause impurity, literally, right, by doing things between man and man. And one of them is stealing. So make sure that you don't have any vestige of stealing. And even if something is stolen, and there's nobody to return it to, you stole it from a convert and he died, and he has no relatives, you have to make sure you give that thing stolen back and get rid of the take off the taint of the fact that it's a stolen property. Because God's presence can't be in a place where they're stealing. Because God distanced himself with stealing. The next topic in the Sedra is the Sota. Now, in order to really appreciate what this is, what Sota is, it's basically Shalom Bayis. It's basically, once you have God in your camp, bring him into your home. Make it more personal. But when there is a chance that a woman committed adultery, then it's not going to be Shalom Bayis. So if she's guilty, we want to get rid of her, because she brings Tum of Gilui Arayis into the Machane, and the God's presence can't be there. But what if she's really innocent? Then we want to clear her of any guilt so she can live together with her husband. Her husband will once again live with her without any qualms. So that brings Shalom Bayis. That's why the whole idea of Sota is not to hurt the woman. It's to enable her, if she's innocent, to get back with a normal, healthy relationship with her husband. Now let me explain how that works, because usually it's looked upon just the opposite. Usually it's looked upon, a guy gets up in the morning and he says, oh, I think my wife committed adultery, right? He just suspects her. He puts her through this terrible ordeal, right? It's not what happens. What happens is the following. A man sees that his wife is overly friendly with somebody, and he sees that something could happen if this continues on. So he tells his wife in front of witnesses, makes it very official, I do not want you to be secluded with that man. Now, she's not allowed to be secluded with that man even if her husband said nothing, because it's usher to be b'yichud with somebody who's not your husband. Okay? And for that man to be secluded with somebody else's wife. That's prohibited from the Torah. So the husband didn't have to say anything. So she's anyway not allowed to do that. But he made it a point to say, I don't like what's going on. I don't want you to be alone with this man. Okay. In front of witnesses, he told her, warned her. And then she ignored him. She ignored the Torah. And she was alone with that man in front of two witnesses. Not, they weren't in the room. They went into a hotel room together, and there are two witnesses outside the hotel room that vouch that they went in and locked the door. They don't know what's going on inside. The woman says, we were playing checkers. And the husband's not sure. Right? He suspects that maybe they weren't playing checkers. Okay. Now, the woman has a choice. If the woman is really guilty, okay, and they weren't playing checkers, then what's it called? All she has to say is, look, I don't want to go through this process. She doesn't even have to admit her guilt. She just says, I don't want to go through the process. Right? I'm not interested. All that happens to her is she has to get divorced. She doesn't get her ksuba. Finished. That's it. She can marry anybody else she chooses to, except the guy that she committed adultery with. She can never marry him, never live with him, and she can't live with her husband. She has to get divorced. That's all that happens. We're not going to kill her because there's no witnesses that she committed adultery. In order to kill a woman who committed adultery, or for that matter, the man also, You need two witnesses who see the act of adultery, warn them that if you do this, you're going to get a death penalty. They have to say, we know and we don't care. And then they do it immediately. Then they get death penalty. Okay, so this is not what happened over here. Nobody knows what happened in the room. All the witnesses can say is, we saw them go into a hotel room and lock the door. We don't know what happened behind the door. So there's no way the woman or the man can get killed. The most that can happen is that she'll say, I'm not going through this process, meaning, I'm afraid because I am guilty. And therefore, we tell her husband, divorce her, can't live with her anymore, don't give her a ksuba, and you can never marry the other man. That's it. Okay. It's her choice. If she says, no, I'm innocent. Okay, I wasn't 100% did proper things, but I didn't commit adultery. And I'm still permitted to my husband, and I want to live with my husband. He wants to live with me. He wants to get back with me. But the husband always has in the back of his mind, maybe it's not true, maybe she's lying. So the Torah gave a way that she can prove her innocence. She has to go through this process. She, what's it called, they dishevel her and embarrass her, what's it called, they take off her head covering and they tear her clothing in order to make it clear that she should be, that if she really is guilty, she should admit and just get her over with this. We don't want to kill her, we don't die. Wanted to admit and then finish with this. But if after all this she's still adamant, so then obviously she really believes that she's innocent. Well, then she brings a sacrifice, a meal offering, and she takes an oath that she's innocent, and the oath is written on a parchment, and the words of the oath, which includes God's name, are dissolved in water. That water is mixed with some earth from the Mishkan or from the Beis HaMikdash, from the floor, and she drinks it. If she's guilty, the water kills her, miraculously, because there's nothing in it that's poison. It's just water, some sand, and ink. If she's guilty, it kills her. If she's innocent, not only doesn't anything bad happen to her, but she's healed. If she never had children, she'll have children. If she had, what's it called, boys, she'll have girls. If she had girls, she'll have boys. If she had hard pregnancies, she'll have easy pregnancies, and it'll be clear that she's innocent. So the whole purpose of this is not to punish her, because she has the ability to say, I don't want to go through it. And nothing happens to her except that she has to get divorced. It's only if she claims to be innocent and she wants to continue living with her husband, and she wants her husband to believe her, then the Torah gave this way of divine proof that she's innocent. That's all. So the whole purpose of this is to bring shalom bayis. Where does God's presence really devolve? Between husband and wife. Ish v'isha shchina shuriyah b'neihem. So once you have the Klal Yisrael in its camps around the Mishkan, we want to bring the Shechina even closer into the home. But in order for that, you have to have Shalom Bayis. So this is the parsha of Shalom Bayis, the extreme of making peace between husband and wife, where the woman did something that is not proper, but she's really innocent of anything terrible, and she can still make amends and live with her husband, right? That, or get rid of her, because if she's really guilty, right, then she doesn't admit it, then the water's going to kill her, right? Or she'll get divorced, and we won't have these kind of marriages. So this also enhances the fact that people can have a connection to God's presence because the homes are holy and pure. That's the next thing. Then, hold on the question. Then there is what's called the next topic in the Sedra, Nazir. A Nazir is a person who vows not to drink wine, and he elevates himself or herself, a woman can do this too, to the level of a Kohen Gadol. And he's not allowed, or she's not allowed, to defile themselves to anybody dead, even a relative. A regular Kohen can defile himself to his 7 close relatives, but a Kohen Gadol can't even defile himself to his 7 close relatives. So the Nazir becomes holy with a crown of holiness and purity, and is totally removed from any kind of connection to the dead, because connection to God is total life, and it negates any connection to death. Atem hadveikim b'Hashem Elokeichem chayim kulchem ayam. You who are attached to God, You're totally alive. Don't have any connection to death. That's a Kohen Gadol. So then, once we have the Shechina, that now the Jewish people can, make their camps around it, and they can bring Kedusha into the camp, then we want them to bring Kedusha into their home. And now we want to bring them Kedusha into themselves. One thing after another. First the camp, then the home, then into each individual. Each individual can become like a Kohen Gadol. Man, woman, can be like a Kohen Gadol. And so that's the next topic. All of this is the same thing. It's all to prepare for the goal. The goal is not that God's presence is here. The goal is that we're attached to it. We're attached to it as a people. We're attached to it as individuals within that people. We're attached to it with our homes. And we're attached to it with our being, individually. And anything that would prevent God's presence from remaining and attach and us attaching to it, we send away. All of that is part of the Sedra. What's the finishing point? Birkas Kohanim. The blessing the Kohanim give of Shalom. Shalom means perfection. Put my name on the Jewish people and I'll bless them. So now the Kohanim, who represent the place where God's presence devolves, put God's name on the Jewish people, and now God's presence and perfection, what's it called, is with them. That is the goal. That is what it's all about. That perfection. Perfection of the individual, perfection of the home, perfection of the camp, of the nation, attaching to God. And that bracha, Birkas Kohanim, Yivarechecha, Yoer, Yisa, V'yosem Lecha Shalom, God should give you perfection. Put, God is harmony, perfection. That's what God is. And you attach yourself to God, you attach yourself to that perfection. And the Kohanim are there to put God's name on you, to bless you, and to connect you to God. That is the goal. Once we have what the goal is, now we speak about the means. So how did that happen? Then God's presence came into the Mishkan, and they consecrated it, and then we have the means, now we can have the goal. That is what this Sedra is all about. I was thinking with that to explain something about Shavuos. Shavuos, we celebrate on the sixth day of Sivan. But according to the opinion that seems to be the opinion that we follow for side reasons, the Torah was not given till the seventh day of Sivan. Rabbi Yossi says, if for whatever reason Moshe Rabbeinu added one day and pushed off the giving of the Torah from the sixth to the seventh. So really it was given on the seventh day of Sivan. And we don't celebrate the seventh day. Seventh day is the day after Shavuos. Yet we say Zman Matan Torah Seinu on Shavuos. This is the time of the giving of our Torah. L'chora, it's not the time of the giving of the Torah. The Torah wasn't given until the next day, actually. So some say, well, it was supposed to be given on the sixth, and even though Moshe pushed it off, this is the time the Torah was supposed to be given. But we don't say the time the Torah was. We say Zman Matan Torah Seinu. But here it could say the same thing. What was the purpose of giving the Torah? That we should have the Torah, or that we should be able through the Torah to attach ourselves to God? That we should be able to have that closeness to the Ribbono Shel Olam. When did we actually show that we could have that closeness? Already on the 6th. On the 6th, it was possible already God could have given the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu said they're not ready 100%. They're not as pure as they could be. I want to push it off another day that the Jewish people be more pure and more ready. So what do we see on the 6th? That the main purpose of the Torah is not that the Torah should be here, but that we should be able to attach to it. So on the 6th we understood it's Zman Matan Torah Seinu. It's not that the Torah is the goal. The Torah is only the means. The goal is that through the Torah we should attach to God. And therefore if we weren't ready on the 6th, it's kedai to push it off another day. If the purpose of the Torah, so give the Torah when it's supposed to be given. But if the purpose is our attachment to God through the Torah, and giving on the 6th wouldn't accomplish that as best as waiting another day, then wait another day. So the fact that the Torah wasn't given on the 6th shows that this is our Torah, that the main purpose of the Torah is not the Torah, but to enable the Jewish people to attach themselves to God through it. That's why we celebrate the 6th. We don't celebrate the actual giving of the Torah, because then we would think that that's the goal. The actual goal is, once we have a Torah, to attach ourselves to God. And therefore, if being able to attach yourself to God through the Torah will be affected better tomorrow than today, then don't give it today. Even though from the Torah standpoint, the sooner the better. But no, it's not. That's not the purpose. The purpose is not there should be a Torah. Just like the purpose is not that God's presence should be in this world. The purpose is that once God's presence is in the world, attach yourself to it. So if that's the goal, then we'll wait another day so we can have the goal achieved in a better way. So that is what's it called, same idea we have over here, that the Torah preceded the goal to the means, because the goal is always more important than the means. Same thing, the Torah preceded the goal of the Torah by pushing it off to the means, which is the actual receiving of the Torah. That's not what we celebrate. We celebrate the ability to understand that once the Torah is given, the purpose of it is that we should attach ourselves through it to God. And if waiting another day will make us more fit for that, then it's good to wait another day, even though the Torah won't be in the world for another day. But that's not the goal of the Torah. The goal of the Torah is that we should be a table attached. It's worth waiting another day for. Yeah.
If that's the case, why wouldn't we celebrate the seventh day now in commemoration of that idea that we need to be ready to receive it? It's not the day.
Because that idea became evident on the sixth day when the Torah wasn't given. Since the Torah was supposed to be given on the 6th, and God agreed with Moshe Rabbeinu that it's kedai to push it off, on the 6th day we learned this lesson of what the purpose of the Torah is. Torah we get every day. Every day is a giving of the Torah, receiving it. But not every day do we appreciate what the goal is. That's what we celebrate.
Got it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
The story of the Sotah, has it ever been enacted?
The Gemara says that there gives stories of it happening, so it must have happened, yeah.
It must have happened.
Yeah.
It's not like
it's not one of the things that never happened and just there to learn or whatever.
Yeah,
the Gemara does say
like
cases of it happened.
Son.
Right. The Gemara said, right. The Gemara does say it happened. Yeah.
So, a Torah is, it's not an end in itself, it's for increasing the ability to have the vagus connect.
The what?
Increasing our ability to attach to Hashem.
Right. That it enables that, right? The Torah was given to enable us to attach ourselves to Hashem. That's the means. Yeah.
Doesn't it say that Torah is like the, you know, the beginning, the end, everything? Like Torah is the whole purpose
it
of
is,
creation.
It is, but it says that two things are the purpose of creation. Bishvil HaTorah, Shenikra Reishis, and Bishvil Yisrael. Now the purpose is not that Yisrael was created for the sake of the Torah, but the Torah was created for the sake of Yisrael. God wanted to create a human being that would attach to him. And he wanted to put him in a world where he'd be able to do that. So he created a world through the Torah where that world could attach him to God. Not that God wanted a Torah in this world and he needed people to keep it, so he created the Jewish people to keep it. Just the opposite.